the mountain. And his last words, which were, "Nothing is true, everything is permitted." Now this, a very similar statement, of course, was made by Aleister Crowley. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. In other words, do what you want to do. But I feel that only one person in a million knows what they want to do, and still fewer are able to do it. So instead of being sort of an invitation to license, it is very much the contrary. You know, it's probably the most difficult of all disciplines to find out what you really want to do. Now, let me get back to my list here. I also talked briefly about Jane Bowles, and I now have the book, the last copy, I'm afraid. It's extraordinary. I mean, just one little scene, and it couldn't be anybody but Jane Bowles. It's incredibly distinguished, particularly in the dialogue. And she's very good with conversations with bus drivers and policemen and that sort of exchange. This is from Two Serious Ladies, which is set in Panama. Very, very funny novel, I think. A policeman stopped and stood a few feet away from them. The negress released Mrs. Copperfield's hand and bounded across the street laughing. "Wasn't that the strangest thing you've ever seen?" said Mrs. Copperfield breathlessly. "You better mind your own business," said the policeman. "Why don't you go over and look at the stores? Everybody walks along the streets where the stores are. Buy something for your uncle or your cousin." "No, that's not what I want to do," said Mrs. Copperfield. "Well, then go to a movie," said the policeman, walking away. And here's a very funny scene. Mrs. Copperfield and this whore Pacifica are sleeping in this room, and one of Pacifica's clients comes and starts banging on the door. And So Pacifica's trying to get her to help her move a bureau in front of the door to block it, and Miss Copperfield became hysterical. "No, no, I've always promised myself that I would open the door if someone's trying to break in. He would be less of an enemy then. The longer he stays out there, the angrier he will get. The first thing I will say to him when I open the door is, 'We are your friends,' and then perhaps he will be less angry." That's very typical Janie Bowles. There's a very funny scene in the bar where Mrs. Quill, the proprietor of this whorehouse, runs up a bill she can't pay in her exchange with the assistant manager. So Mrs. Quill calls in Mrs. Copperfield to bail her out, and Mrs. Copperfield arrives wearing a silver fox cape, despite the heat. Although she was perspiring and badly made up, she felt assured of being treated with a certain amount of deference by the hotel employees because of the silver fox cape. Very much the contrary. She starts talking to the manager, and he just looks at her. The assistant manager looked down with loathing at Mrs. Copperfield's upturned face. He hated her sharp features and her high voice. He found her even more disgusting than Mrs. Quill. He was not fond of women anyway. And here is a very something that only Janie could have written in Plain Pleasures. Mr. Drake was saying very slowly with a dreamy look in his eye, "If I believe in a lot of unnecessary changing around, a lot of going back and forth, I mean. When I was a younger man, I had a chance to go way down south to Florida. I had an offer to join forces with an alligator farm project, but there was no security in the alligators." Pure Jane Bowles. This is Paul's book, The Sheltering Sky, which has recently been reissued by the Echo Press. I think it was really out of print before then. It's a very special thing that he does in the first two books, The Sheltering Sky and Let It Come Down. It's sort of a heavy, palpable darkness, like underexposed film. It's very special and very sinister. Here's a passage from the typhoid delirium. This man is actually dying of typhoid fever. Incidentally, Bowles had typhoid fever, so he's talking about something that he knows about. The street led up a steep hill where the hot sun was shining. The sidewalks were crowded with pedestrians looking at the shop windows. He had a feeling there was traffic in the side streets, but the shadows there were dark. An attitude of expectancy was growing in the crowd. They were waiting for something, for what he did not know. The entire afternoon was tense, poised, ready to fall. At the top of the street, a huge automobile suddenly appeared, glistening in the sunlight. It came careening over the crest and down the hill, swerving savagely from one curb to the other. A great yell rose up from the crowd. He turned and frantically sought a doorway. At the corner, there was a pastry shop, its windows full of cakes and meringues. He fumbled along the wall if he could reach the door. He wheeled, stood transfixed. In the tremendous flash of sunlight reflected from the glass as it splintered, he saw the metal pinning him to the stone. He heard his cry and felt his bowels pierce through. As he tried to topple over to lose consciousness, he found his face a few inches from a row of pastries, still intact on their paper-covered shelf. Now, there's a very good passage in the end of this novel. This Kit, the wife of the man that died of typhoid, has been lost in the desert where this sheik has sort of made her his love slave. But anyway, the woman from the consulate, so they found her and brought her back, and the woman from the consulate is seeing her to her hotel. And she says, the Sahara, the woman from the consulate, this is Mrs. Perry, the Sahara is a small place, really, when you come right down to it. People just don't disappear there. It's not like it is here in the city, in the Kasbah. Well, then Miss Ferry realizes that, finally she says, my God, the woman's nuts, she said to herself. She opened the door, jumped down, and ran into the hotel to the desk. Took a little while to make herself understood. A few minutes later, two men walked out to the waiting cab. They looked inside, glanced up and down the sidewalk. Then they spoke questioningly to the driver, who shrugged his shoulders. At that moment, a crowded streetcar was passing by, filled largely with native dock workers in blue overalls. Inside it, the dim lights flickered, the standees swayed. Rounding the corner and clanging its bell, it started up the hill past the Café de la Porte, where the awnings flapped in the evening breeze, past the Bar Metropole, past the Café de France, shining with mirrors and brass. Scraped around another corner and began the slow ascent of the Avenue Guillani. Below, the harbor lights came into view and were distorted in the gently moving water. Then the shabbier buildings loomed, the streets were dimmer. At the edge of the Arab Quarter, the car made a wide U-turn and stopped. It was the end of the line. This nymphomaniac woman has just wandered off into the native quarter to stay lost, obviously. Let me see. The Let It Come Down, I think that's out of print. I like that even better than The Sheltering Sky. It's cast all in Tangiers. And there's a tremendous passage in the end of it where this man in a hashish delirium drives a nail into someone's ear. I mean, the guy's sleeping and drives a nail into his ear. He always leaves his characters in a dead-end, absolutely dead-end situation. Well, I guess a lot of you have read Nightwood by Deanna Barnes. She hasn't written anything in many years, although she's still alive, but very much a recluse. I've talked about Selene. The Heart is a Lonely Hunter by Carson McCullers, I believe, was written when she was 20 years old. It's still a very, very good book. And I always thought one of the greatest things in it is this dream, this nightmare that the man has. I can't exactly quote it, but it's in an eastern city, and he's carrying something around, and the fear just builds up. And it gave me the idea for a dream anthology of famous dreams in fiction. That would certainly be one that I would include. I can't really attempt to go into Beckett here. I mean, that would be a whole course. Here's a writer, Julian Green, not very well known. Genet said about him, he does not have the courage to be a writer. He said he's a Catholic pederast, and he really doesn't have the courage. I can't quite agree with this. He's written some very fine short stories in the supernatural area, which I think are very effective, particularly The Pilgrim on the Earth. And also a book called If I Were You, which takes up the matter of changing, people switching identities. This man has the power to switch identities with other people so he could become them. But he had to say certain words, and some people would knock him on his ass before he could get the words out. But it's an interesting book. Now here are two sort of period pieces, Cytherea and the Green Hat. The Green Hat by Michael Arlen. Everyone read it in the 1920s. And I tried to reread it recently. It's on here more as a sort of a curiosity, like a wooden Indian. But everybody read it in the 20s, and this Green Hat was sort of a bell-shaped hat, became the uniform of the Jazz Age, the Jazz Age flapper. So it had a great influence. It now seems incredibly wooden. You wonder if people really did talk like that and say such things and do such things. Here's someone named Boy Fenwick yet who throws himself out of a window on his wedding night when he finds out his bride isn't a virgin. My God. And Cytherea was a great shocker of the 20s. This middle-aged man has an affair with this woman and she has heart trouble and dies while he's laying her. Any of you read Kane's book by Alex Troche? Oh, yes. It's, I don't know if it's even in print now. I haven't seen it in a long while. He's a very good friend of mine. This is one of the early junkie books, drug books, and a very good one. The Wild Party and the Setup. Are any of you acquainted with those poems? They're written in the 20s and are very typical. I just remember, I quote one couplet from The Wild Party talking about this punch-drunk fighter. After he'd had his 10th scotch, a man to be careful of and watch, and when he was mixing gin and rum, a man to stay well away from. I've got some Julian Green on here, the earlier books. I sort of lost him with Travels with My Aunt. But these early books are very good and very skillful. There's not too much to say about them. And Evelyn Waugh seemed awfully funny when I first read him in the late 20s. And, well, he's still fairly funny. I'm going to skip over the Alexandrian Quartets by Lawrence Durrell. Certainly worth reading. The whole idea of the same story really being told by four people is very well worked out. And here's Opium by Jean Cocteau. It's quite a good book on the subject, actually. I mean, there are insights in there. He mentions the incompatibility of opium and alcohol and the fact of milk being, to some extent, an antidote for opium. But I say still the best book on the subject is De Quincey, Confessions of an English Opium Eater, which they have in the bookstore here. I mean, he said it all about use for pain and use, addiction, overuse, and withdrawal. He built himself up to a huge amount of opium, and then he built himself down again to a moderate quantity. There's a very funny passage in here, one of my favorite passages, about Coleridge. He's quite bitchy about Coleridge, really. It is notorious that in Bristol, to that I can speak myself, but probably in many other places, he, Coleridge it is, went so far as to hire men, porters, hackney coachmen, and others, to oppose by force his entrance into any druggist's shop. But as the authority for stopping him was derived simply from himself, naturally these poor men found themselves in a metaphysical fix, not provided for even by Thomas Aquinas or by the prince of Jesuitical casuists. In this excruciating dilemma would occur such scenes as the following. "Oh, sir," would plead the suppliant porter, suppliant yet semi-imperative, for equally if he did and if he did not show fight, the poor man's daily 5 shillings seemed endangered. "Billy, you must not consider, sir, your wife and transcendental philosopher. "Wife? What wife? I have no wife." Porter, "But really now you must not, sir. Didn't you say no longer ago than yesterday?" Transcendental philosopher, "Pooh, pooh. Yesterday is a long time ago. Are you aware, my man, that people are known to have dropped down dead for timely want of opium?" "Hey, but you tell us me not to hearken." Transcendental philosopher, "Oh, nonsense, an emergency, a shocking emergency has arisen, quite unlooked for. No matter what I told you in time long past, that's what I now tell you is, get out of my way." Well, Sherry and LaFanchery, there's no trouble about finding Colette. She's all over the bookstores. Very special sort of female writing and very, very good. The Treasure of the Sierra Madre made a very good film, but I think is rather an indifferent book. I was disappointed reading the book after the film. And, of course, yes. I don't know. The strong scene in the film was the scene with the bandits, right? That was the big thing. Well, this is much more diffuse in the book. You didn't get the real impact as much. No, I mean when the bandits, you see Boggs or whatever his name is, he's forgotten that his pistol is empty. So when he pulls it, this is supposed to, you know, this is supposed to stop these three guys. And they just say you can only shoot one at this distance and just close in on him. And then they find the pistol is empty and they say, "Huh, look at him and cut his head off." But it certainly was a very fine movie. Well, The Oblivion Seekers by Isabel Eberhardt, I think, shows how much Paul Bowles owes to her. It's a lot in common with Paul Bowles. Now, these short stories, this is a very short list, actually. Many could be added, and I have added some in the supplementary list here. But A Short Trip Home by Fitzgerald is, I think, one of the finest ghost stories in the language. And ghost stories, good ghost stories, very, very rare. It's the most difficult of all genres, I think, to make a ghost story that is really convincing, that is really chilling. There was a curious fact connected with this Short Trip Home. In a footnote by Fitzgerald, he said that he had inadvertently included in this story a passage from another book, and he decided to leave it in there. But I never found out what book. That's something that would be an interesting bit of research. He does just that little note. And there's that also the fact that it is usually omitted from anthologies and is hard to find. There is something really ghostly about the story itself. And The House in the Brain by Bulwer Lytton is, I think, one of the best ghost stories. And it's quite modern because the real horror of the... how many of you read it? It's also called The Haunted and the Haunters. But The House in the Brain is really what it's about. Has no one read it? No one has read The House in the Brain? Good heavens. Well, when I was a kid, everybody read it. It was one of the classical ghost stories. And it's hard to find a class that hadn't read it. I read it when I was about 12, I think. It's very good, and it's modern because it's about this man that has some way of being immortal. But the real evil in this house is obviously radioactivity. There's this room where it's very strong, and then when they tear it up, they find some kind of a compass, and he touches it, and he gets this shock. And, of course, The Turn of the Screw. Well, that's, I think many of you have read that. But here's a very good one called The Furman Child. I'm talking about ghost stories in the Fontana Book of Great Ghost Stories, about a changeling child. It really got something of a chill to it. And One of the Dead from A Walk with the Beast. I started reading this in a barber shop, and didn't notice the author, and it was years later that I finally tracked it down again. And then there's the stories, the very gruesome stories by Flannery O'Connor, who ran a pig farm down in Georgia somewhere. And also the short stories of Tennessee Williams, which I think are very fine, they impressed me more than his plays, actually. And The Snows of Kilimanjaro, I think that is the best thing that Hemingway ever wrote. I mean, he could have stopped right there. It's the last passage is, I forget, the white, as far as the eye can see, The Snows of Kilimanjaro. It was, of course, a story about death and one of the better stories about death in the English language. But in the movie, this phantom plane becomes a real plane, and the guy gets out with the penicillin to cure the man's gangrene. I mean, I would say was enough to kill a writer right there to see his, to sell a title and see them botch his work like that. With the top of his head blown off, he couldn't have made a very good-looking corpse. He was always talking about good-looking corpses. Hemingway was certainly a man that was imprisoned in his own style. He had so much style that everything is Hemingway. He's often considered to be a master of dialogue, and I don't agree with this at all. Nobody talks that way except in Hemingway stories. You know, in The Killers, where one killer says, "What do they do here at night?" and the other one says, "They're in this diner where they haven't been able to get anything they want because everything we want is on the dinner." They said, "They eat the dinner. They all come here and eat the big dinner." It was generally conceded that the most atrocious conceit in the English language was, I think it was written by Dryden on Lord Somebody's Smallpox. "Each little pimple had a tear in it to wail the fault its rising did commit." But Hemingway almost went that one better. He said, his guy line there, he said, the hole in the front of his head where the bullet went in was about the size of a pencil. The hole in the back of his head where the bullet came out was big enough to put your fist in, if it was a small fist and you wanted to put it there. Yeah. Well, some of these bestsellers, all bestsellers are not necessarily bad books. I consider The Shining in the last course. It's good. It really is. Well made, and it's got quite a few real chills in it, I think. And The Godfather, well, it's pretty shameless PR for the mafia. All these charming old gentlemen indeed, God almighty. They live right around me in New York. But it did say some very interesting and important things about power. And, of course, it is a formula bestseller. There are two main formulas for the bestseller. One is something that people know something about and want to know more about, like the mafia or the inside of Hollywood or what happens in a hospital, all that kind of thing. And, of course, the other is the menace and the removal of the menace. Jaws would be one of those, and all these plague stories, disaster stories. Now, the Day of the Jackal and the Dogs of War, three books that he wrote, I think are very, very good indeed. They, of course, fall into the category of what people know something about and want to know more about. The Day of the Jackal, of course, is about this man who's an assassin who's going to try to assassinate de Gaulle. One of the most difficult tests, because de Gaulle had superb bodyguards, really intuitive bodyguards. If Kennedy had had bodyguards like de Gaulle had, they wouldn't have got him. And they tried again and again. There's a very good scene where they have sprayed de Gaulle's car with machine gun bullets, and he's just brushing the glass off himself, saying, encore une fois, once again. He was certainly fearless, the general, there's no doubt about that. But the interesting thing about this, it has come full circle from the psychological novel. This killer... we never know what he thinks, just what he does. There's absolutely no psychological insight, how he got to be a killer, anything. He just walks in from nowhere, and in the end of the book, you're left wondering whether he existed at all, because they finally trace him down, and they got the wrong man. He always has a little twist in the end of his books like that. The Dogs of War, of course, about these mercenaries who take over a country, sort of like Uganda. I mean, they displace a dictator, in other words. He's very knowledgeable. See, he was a correspondent for the Tribune, and he's talking about people and situations that he does know about. Frederick Forsyth. He's written, those are the three books. I heard that he feels that he's made enough money and he doesn't want to write anymore, because there's a lot of research and work that goes into them. Another thing, like they probably were written as, you see, it's the Dogs of War. They got so many days to prepare. And you get, this day, that day, that day. And he probably wrote it in the same way. So he just blocked out like that and gave himself some sort of a deadline. They're very good books. How many of you read The Magus by John Fold? Uh-huh. Yeah. I think it's good. I read it under the best circumstances. I was on the island of Spetsai, where it takes place, and the tourist agent lent it to me. And I rode out to see the house, the supposed house of the Magus. Fell off my horse, too. This is a good book, The Interview with the Vampire by Anne Rice. How many read it? Mm-hmm. Well, I think it says some very interesting things about the impasses of physical immortality. I found it quite touching, really. Some of these. The Nightcomers by Michael Hastings. That is simply a retelling of the... Turn of the Screw, using the same characters. I mean, this just it isn't a successful book. I just put it on here illustrating that now, you know, the idea, the whole concept of originality is really pretty dead, that that's a perfectly legitimate thing to do if you write a good book. And Jaws 2, by Hank Searles, based on the screenplay by Howard Sackler and Dorothy Tristan, inspired by Jaws, the Jaws 1. Well, that shows you how far, I mean, this tendency towards using any material you want can be carried. Well, Nightwing is about vampire bats, rabid vampire bats. And there's a whole batch of these books. This is just typical, the rats, the birds, the cats, and so on. This book, I doubt very much if you can find it. It's maybe out of print, but it would make a good film. It's about a prospector, gold prospector, who finds some gold these natives have, and he comes back and wants permission to exploit this. So he goes to this guy who's a very much a CIA type, who immediately begins figuring how he can get the gold. And he sends two anthropologists out. And these anthropologists, one is they go out there and poison all the natives with bully beef that they've injected poison into. Well, that's nothing new. I mean, white men are always doing things like that, you know, coming in with their big smile and poisoning bully beef. But that's a pretty old story. But the perpetrators are completely atypical. There's a snippy closet queen who believes in native magic and prides himself on having no racial prejudice, and his superior, who's a well-known cultural anthropologist. You see, they're sort of pillars of the liberal establishment, you know, always ready to write letters about an endangered species or mistreatment of native populations. And they're just as corrupt as the prospector who talks about the natives as bloody apes. So it's another of these stories, sort of like the Outcast of the Islands, of white corruption. And also, I got a phrase from that I later used, Artie type, no principles. The denouement, the district supervisor, whatever they call him, said, bad show. Bad for the territory, bad for the administration, bad for the natives, said Emma. Washington, understandable, arty type, no principles. But Warwick, he was a good fellow, can't understand it. It's not a very good book, but I think would make a very good film.
What's the title?
It's called Beat Not the Bones. Beat Not the Bones.
Yeah.
Pardon? Oh, yeah, sure. Where am I? I'm coming to the science fiction section. And to my way of thinking, science fiction is a very difficult genre. And very, very few science fiction books, you can go in there, whole stacks of them, convince you that it ever happened or ever could have happened anywhere. They're just, it's a great lack of verisimilitude or conviction. Well, here's a very good one, Fury by Henry Kuttner, and I'm afraid it's out of print. Henry Kuttner's dead, and when they republished some of his books, they left out this is the best thing, the only thing he ever did. It's, I can't give you the whole plot. It's on the planet Venice, and they've got a lot of exotic drugs and so on. It's really convinces you. I mean, you feel that he's talking about a place. Three to Conquer by Eric Frank Russell, who's also dead. is, I think, one of the best books on the whole subject of virus invasion, that is, a virus or a parasite taking over a human body. And there's with this one telepath who can detect this. He can tell right away. And he describes the parasite is speaking in little squigs and giggles and turkey gobbles. It's quite chilling and quite convincing. Now, this changeling Earth, now, lots of times you open one of these books, you know, and you see some unpronounceable name, so-and-so, and a whole lot of titles like Custodian of the Third Level of Cherubine or some such stuff as that. And here's one that starts off with a bang. You get it. It's called Changeling Earth by Fred Superhagen. And starts off and really pulls the reader in. They're preparing a man for death by slow impalement, for the amusement of the Emperor of the East, who sat in thoughtful silence amid the blooming, drowsy richness of his summer garden. On the sloping lawn, a little below the Emperor, John Omenor's simple chair and a simple name, too, you can remember it. The sharpened stake had been set up in a space framed by formal plantings of tall flowers. And the man who was to die let out his first unbelieving cry as the sharpened wood began to have its way with him. John Omenor had not been paying close attention to the preparations. He had larger matters on his mind today, but now he uttered a small sound of satisfaction and leaned back a little in his chair. Well, there you've got a beginning that catches your interest, and you know this guy's going to get his comeuppance sooner or later, which of course he does. This critical threshold book by Brian Stableford, I do recommend. He really took on a subject that he couldn't quite finish. You see, he had the idea that these people who had been stranded on this planet, and then a search team or a team of anthropologists, whatever, comes out and see what has happened. They had been so altered by this butterfly hormone, when the butterflies mated, that they weren't human at all. They'd lost language and were utterly horrified to see a human being, which they saw some way to left in a telepathic way. And let's see, wait a minute. Put that one bit here. And then he saw me, and he didn't like what he saw. An expression came over his face, more than fear, something like horror. He cringed, averting his face, but flicking his gaze back and forth. I can understand his being frightened, but I was at a loss to explain the fact that he seemed to be physically affected by what he saw, almost nauseated. No human being ever looked at me that way before. Well, and there's a telepath there, but we never find out what he saw. That's all he says about it. I think in a way that is cheating. That is, he builds up this expectation that you're going to find something out which you don't find out. At any rate, if anyone wanted to carry that idea further, there certainly would be quite legitimate. There, Walk to the End of the World by Susie McKay Charnos, about a world dominated by men where women are complete underlings. Is also a convincing book. And here's The World Records by Marion Zimmer Bradley. She's written a lot of these dark over books. This is one of the better ones, about people who set out to wreck a world by lousing up the ecology and so forth, and you wonder as you read it whether world wreckers aren't at work here. It's just a team of people that move in, and all they're doing is just wrecking things, lousing everything up, setting one faction against another, and so on. Well, these science fiction books that I have on the list here, all I think have good parts in them. Some of them are better than others, but some of them have just like Nightmare Blue, which has about 3 good pages in it. Same with the Dream Fields and the Dreaming Earth. The Terminal Man by Michael Crichton, they made a movie out of that, I believe. I think the book is quite good. Who saw the movie, anybody? Is it any good? No. Did you read the book, too? Yeah. Well, the book was good because it's science fact about this guy has a pacemaker in his brain. It's nothing that is beyond the reach of present-day technology. Now, nonfiction books, most of these are information books. That's a different kind of reading. You're reading for information. The Gangs of New York by Herbert Asbury is, it's... No?
Excuse me. You're talking about information, like information data.
Well,
Everything
is information. Yeah. Oh, yeah, but I mean information in the sense of data, like a history book or nonfiction book, like The Gangs of New York is about... historical about the gangs in New York. And specifically in here, I think they're going to make a film based on this. But the by far the most interesting part is the draft riots in 1963 in New York City. There were about 5,000 people killed and whole sections of New York were burned down. And that was actually the beginning of the New York City police. See, the police could not contain the riot. And then they had to call in the army, and they opened up with grape shot on the crowd. But if the police had been able to contain it, they might have stopped it with 40 or 50 casualties. So after that, the police force of New York was completely remodeled and is now an occupying army, as it were, that is prepared to deal with just such a situation as that. It's just from the point of view of information, there's a lot of good ideas for writing in there. I mean, that you could imagine that. Pardon?
When did that riot?
1963. 1853, excuse me. This was during the Civil War, and I think it was the first real draft in America. Well, word went out that the rich were buying their sons out for $300, which is probably true. And that was the pretext for the riot. But the riot really expressed all sorts of long-standing grievances and of people living in terrible slums and terrible conditions and terrible poverty. The Irish were the most prominent in this riot. And it must have been a terrific deal. It went on for about a week. This on my notes. I was talking about this book, the Witch Doctor's Apprentice. Now, this was a woman who went down to South America to gather native remedies and herbs for some big drug company. Now, she found that they had a contraceptive that would last for 7 years. More than that, this could be reversed by another drug if the woman wanted to have children before the 7 years was up. Oh, here we are. Here are my notes on this. A 7-year pill. So she comes back and she thinks, oh, I've got something great here. And no drug company will touch it. Of course not. They can sell a pill a day. A 7-year pill you could make a lot of money right away, would not be profitable in the long run, and big money thinks in the long run. And you see there how absolutely these vested interests are in opposition to the public good. They don't even think about that. They think about money for the stockholders. Now, the fact that such a bill would convey untold blessings on a planet suffering from overpopulation is, of course, not to be even considered, because money doesn't give a shit about the public good. All it gives a shit about is more money. So, of course, the citizen gets fucked around. Now, suppose somebody with know-how and guts, I was taught as a kid that, you know, that you had the good product, you could get, there was always a market, goes down there and gets the formula, comes back in, starts making it in a basement laboratory. Well, that's when the FDA comes in. You'd never get the okay to distribute it. And, of course, the FDA supports the whole medical establishment, the AMA and the FDA. So that is book is very interesting from that point of view, and it's quite an authentic book. I know the area in which she was, and I'd heard about some of these remedies. That was only one. There were several others, equally useful. One I think was specifically for healing bones, but the drug companies just didn't want to touch it. So. The book was written in 1963. And Keep the River on Your Right, this is a man who went down and lived with cannibals in Peru. Funny, quite an interesting book. And I've spoken, I think in the first lecture I said something about The Science and Sanity by Alfred Korzybski. They have an abbreviated version of that, the Institute of General Semantics in Lakeville, Connecticut. I think everybody in how many of you are acquainted with general semantics, the whole concept of general semantics? Yeah. Well, it's something I think that everybody that goes to a university should read, because it's going to save you so much time, because lots of arguments are purely verbal. They don't mean anything. Generalities, like a good thing, good for who, where and when, always have to be pinned down, or they say, any generalities, the American people, well, that's, what do you mean by the American people, and so on. It's very much worth reading. I think it's just sort of an instrument to save you a lot of time. Now, this experiment with time and the serial universe by John was written in 1924, I believe. Well, he was a physicist and a mathematician, and he started writing his dreams down very carefully, and he found that there was material in these dreams, not only from the past, but from the future. And he says that anyone who writes their dreams down carefully over a period of time will find this to be true. And I have done it, and I certainly have found very clear instances. Now, wait a minute. Yeah. Oh. Now, he observes that when we dream about fires, floods, earthquakes, plane crashes, one is seeing not the future event itself, but the moment when the dreamer will become aware of the event, usually a newspaper picture. What one is seeing then is one's own future time track. Now, I've had instances of this. For example, I saw in a dream, saw a wardrobe sort of floating by. And the next day, this was in Tangiers, I was sitting in the Café de France, and a wardrobe did indeed float by. Somebody was carrying it on a strap, the way they carry furniture in Tangiers. So, but it didn't seem to have any significance beyond that. It was just many of the dreams, future dreams that I've had like that, are precognitive dreams, have been in this purely, seemingly irrelevant. Just never, nothing happened. I never saw the man who was carrying the thing again, and so on. But anyone who will write their dreams down, I think, will confirm that.
Any
pardon? No.
It's primarily about Australian dream
time. Mm-hmm. Australian? You say, is it about Australian natives?
Yeah, it's about Abos.
Uh-huh.
Who actually have as their sacred ground the city of Sydney.
Mm-hmm. Is this was this a movie?
Yeah, it's
a film.
Town.
Oh, really? Well, I'd be interested to see it. Mm-hmm. Well, there's psychic discoveries behind the Iron Curtain, and then there was a handbook of psychic discoveries. It's just information about how far they have gone in Russia with the experiments into psychic. Well, into telepathy and all sorts of psychic manifestations, but mostly being used for political purposes. And Journeys Out of the Body by Robert Monroe, I think, is one of the better books on the whole matter of projection. I've met him. I'm convinced that he is, he's genuine, that he does experience these things, but following his directions, I can't say that I achieved anything very remarkable. But it is one of the better books, certainly, on the subject. And I've got a couple of books on magic here. So many magic books, books on magic, are just windy and full of bullshit. Like Aleister Crowley's books, I really, he may have been a competent black magician, but he wasn't much of a writer, is my feeling. But he is implicated in this Necronomicon, which was published by Barnes Graphics and the Weiser Bookshop in New York. And, well, it's an interesting book. It's I think was concocted by Aleister Crowley and Lovecraft and several other people, although it purports to be the this mad Arab. And they're going to now publish it in paperback so anyone can conjure up abominations in his kitchen. But the I wrote an introduction for the paperback edition. Saying, in effect, that it's time for the these magicians to come out of their circles and into the street. That's a pretty cowardly way of acting, to cower in his magic circle like some mafia don, hidden behind bulletproof glass and giving orders to his hitmen, sending them out to do the jobs he's afraid to do himself. This is the age of confrontation. Meet your demons face to face. Well, the ceremonial magicians are very hidebound indeed. And I doubt that will have much effect. I've got this book, How to Stop Smoking, by Breen on here because I read it and did stop smoking. I've been trying for years. And he guarantees anybody who reads the book, does what he tells them, if they want to stop smoking, they'll stop smoking. I read it, and I did, and a couple of other people I gave it to. It's really quite... it's sort of a Buddhist technique. The first thing you do, instead of you just sit and look at the whole problem. As you want to stop smoking, you can't stop smoking. That is the problem. You just sit and look at it. And if you look at it, then like most problems, just looked at without trying to solve them, will solve themselves. Then you looked at it, and then you just pick a day and stop. That's all. And I did that 3 years ago, and haven't had a cigarette since. So it really works. But it's funny, you know, I should have known those things, but just reading it seemed to have some effect. He was a heavy smoker himself, otherwise no one would pay attention to him, of course. But if anyone wants to start smoking, try reading that book. But that's the base, the main thing is looking at the problem without doing anything about it. Of course, any smoking, stop any program to stop smoking of cutting down is completely wrong. Won't work. And this memory book is interesting. If you pick it up, it shows you some of the actual mechanisms of memory, how memory works on associational lines. And I've used it, and it works. I mean, you can improve your memory. You can remember names and things like that by using the method described in this book. The Natural Way to Draw is actually one of the best how-to books on any subject. It's been so described, and I agree that it is. I mean, if anyone's interested in drawing, that is the best book. Now, some of these books that I taught a course on in film script writing, and these books were the writer and the screen film script writing, these are good sound books on the subject. And while there may not be a technology of writing novels, there certainly is a technology of writing film scripts. There is a way to do it. And these books explain that, the way in which film scripts are written. Let me see. This book in the supplement here, You Can't Win, by Jack Black, I read in 1926. And it was written before sort of the autobiography of a allegedly reformed burglar. It could really make a great film, quite a nostalgic film, because of the turn of the century when burglars and peat men rode the rails, and opium in the back room of the Chinese laundries and jails, and a great character called Salt Chunk Mary. She didn't like talk, and she didn't like talkers. As soon as you walk in the door, she puts a pot of salt chunk on and beans on the wood stove with a blue coffee pot. You eat first, then you talk business. She had more no's than any woman I ever knew, and none of them ever meant yes. She's a real tough type woman, you know, who was a fence and receiver and so on. It's a very interesting book of a whole world that is gone, present time. Pardon? That's called You Can't Win by Jack Black. Now, I found it and had a Xerox made of it, and I hope to get it back into print sometime. That's one of my projects, to get a lot of these books back, some of these books back into print. Just a few more of the, well, of course, all the Castaneda books are, I think, very much worth reading. I don't have to talk too much about them. Now, here's some books by this David Rorvik. And he wrote this book in his image about a man who allegedly had himself cloned, a rich man. Um, Whether this is true or not, which I doubt very much, the idea is interesting, and the information in here. This guy's a scientific reporter. He got a lot of good information in here. It seems they could even recreate King Tutankhamun from. They got enough there to clone him if they perfected the technique. But the interesting thing to me is the objections to cloning. Here are some quotations, just a minute. And these are scientists talking. They're firstly talking about interfering with the designs of the creator. We cannot ethically get to know whether the cloning is feasible, producing monsters in the laboratory, precipitating an identity crisis. And many of these scientists, who you think would know better, are just very much hung up on their identity. Each of us has a right to a special yet unique relationship with the Creator. What that's supposed to mean. Differences of opinion reinforce our sense of self and hence lend support to the feeling of individual worth we seek in ourselves and from others. And selfness is an essential fact of life. The thought of human non-selfness is terrifying. Well, apparently these people never heard of Buddhism. Are they the whole concept of egolessness? And these are scientists. Well, there's no doubt about what they've done. They've cloned mice. They've cloned first they cloned frogs, and then they've cloned mice. And if they can clone mice, they can clone people. There's no doubt about it. And I don't know. It strikes me as being a very good idea. Why not? Huh?
I think they're already doing it in Missouri.
In Missouri? Why in Missouri? Well, I'm from Missouri. I haven't seen it yet, but well, there's no doubt what they can do it. And the other books, Brave New Baby and Man as Machine, he's got a lot of information, you know, so that the frontiers of science, and extrapolating from there. And the fact that very soon they will have artificial parts. See, now they have the, with the transplants, they have the problem of rejection, but if the parts were artificial, then they wouldn't have that problem. You could just replace yourself piece by piece like an old car and apparently live forever. So all these things are on the way. And he's a very good scientific reporter, and those books, I think, are well worth reading. Well, I'll stop here for some questions and discussions and so forth. Yeah. No, on the contrary, man. I tried to sell that Dutch Schultz film script for about 7 years. But I'd be glad to work on a film script. But of course, the big rule in films is never do anything unless you see some money. Unless you see some money. I mean, don't give out any ideas or anything until you have some. Until money changes hands, nothing has happened at all. And that doesn't mean that you may get money, and that may be the end of the project. But
this Dutch Schultz film was somehow a formula or a mega formula.
Pardon?
Did you approach the Dutch Schultz script as a mega formula, or just something you wanted to do, and then?
Well, I was originally interested in the last words of Dutch Schultz, these sort of surrealist 2,000 words on his deathbed. And I sort of based my script on that. I did write it as a film script, yes, And I did want to have it made into a film. That was the point. But I know now, of course, that my after learning a little more about script writing, that the script I had was much too long, too unwieldy, and some of the tricks in it, you know, that you might have a trick that you think is great, but it may not be great at all on the screen. But I certainly tried to sell it for about 7 years. Saw an awful lot of people. Peckinpah was one, and you know, you want to. And at one point, Elliot Gould was going to play Dutch Schultz and produce the film. But that never got off the ground. It's the way it is in any film script. Nothing happens until it happens. They say, oh, yes, positively, and, you know, $6 million, and the next day the secretary won't put you through to the guy. And that's the way it is. Yes. Huh?
A moment.
What are the mechanics of selling these scripts? Sir? Thank you, sir. What are the mechanics of selling these scripts? What do you mean nothing happens until money changes hands?
Exactly that.
Dealing with your agent, you don't want to give them the idea? Or?
Well, yeah, an agent can sell scripts if he is in that particular line of business, but a literary agent doesn't necessarily know how to sell scripts. Scripts are usually sold directly by talking to somebody rather than, you know, by the usual routes. In other words, you got a script, you go and talk to a director. If you get a director, that's part of it. Or conversely, you see, like Terry Southern, when he wanted to make The Magic Christian, he'd been trying for years to line up Peter Sellers. As soon as he got Peter Sellers lined up, then that was it. Then he can get a director. So it's sort of a full-time job selling a film script. But I did talk to a lot of people and, you know, learn something about how film scripts are sold. But they aren't, it's nothing like selling a book. You don't just see, you take a book to a publisher and he accepts it. This, you've got to get out and convince somebody, interest somebody, line people up.
Took a long time for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest to get...
I can't hear you. What?
It took a long time, I guess, for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest to get finally produced.
Yeah. Well, Midnight Cowboy was kicking around Hollywood for about 5 years before anyone took it. Yeah.
Hold it.
Thought I'd answer the question of why Missouri, and that's because, like, you know, Bonnie and Clyde and people like that, Mafia, well, I shouldn't say, the family, you know, they hang out there because it's such an obscure place, you know, they can get away with it. But my question was, smoking is a habit, and I was wondering if you could apply that technique that, you know, you stop smoking to any other habit.
Yeah. Well, this, he's just talking about smoking here, which has some unique features. It isn't quite like any other habit. But some, I guess the same technique would certainly have some applicability to other habits.
And another thing, I had a dream about you, and I was asking you, what was the success of your writing? What was the success of your writing? What did you feel made your writing successful? And in the dream you answered, you didn't use verbs. You wrote without verbs.
I wrote without words?
Verbs.
Oh, without verbs.
And I can't, you know, I don't... That may mean something to you. I just like...
Well, I remember a phrase from Rowdy Vase tapes. He was that guy who got voices on tapes with no, you know, when there's no, nobody was talking. And, well, he did it scientifically, you know. He ruled out that it was radio, that the parts of the machine were picking up radio waves and so on. And one of the phrases there, very enigmatic phrases, was, "We still don't have the nouns." So,
yes. I think it's in the fact that there's no such thing as an accident.
Well, that's my theory. When people say coincidence, what are they talking about? It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, at this point in time, it doesn't mean anything?
Coincidence does not mean anything to me. I mean, when they say, oh, it's just a coincidence. Like I pointed out in this walk exercise, if you do it, you'll see the same person. You meet him in a grocery store, I mean, a stranger. You see him in a grocery store, you see him here, you see him there, and you see him there. But it isn't coincidence to me at all. It's something to do with synchronicity. In some way, you at that point, you are synchronizing. You're in his groove in some way. And he's not following you or anything. It's just that you are in the same area. But I don't see that that isn't a coincidence to me. That is much more than a coincidence. In fact, I think coincidence is a meaningless word.
How does that work in the dreams? Like, what's the difference between the dream and the conscious, the waking state?
Well, there are the obvious differences, of course. But I think that I don't make so much distinction. I think that dreams are quite as real as a waking state. And who's to tell the difference? Because it actually, of course, the dreaming process goes on at all times anyway. It goes on when you're awake. It's just that you are paying attention to external, you know, to getting yourself around and crossing streets and things. But Dunn made that observation. He said that he just had to close his eyes and in the waking state, and he could contact the dream area. It's going on at all times. I think it's better. Yeah.
Have you ever thought about theater?
I have thought about it, and I've tried it, but I've never, somehow I didn't ever click. I may come to it.
What was it?
Hmm?
I was looking at a microphone.
Repeat the question.
Yes. Have you ever thought of writing for theater, for plays, with theater?
Yes, as I said, I've thought about it. I've thought about it and I've tried it, but I never it didn't seem to click somehow. So I've never really done anything. No, I don't really. I don't read many plays, nor see many plays.
Any reason for that, or just not interested in plays, or?
Hmm?
Any reason for not seeing plays, or?
Well, they come at an inconvenient time, you know. They sort of louse up your evening. but actually, I don't know. I just I'd rather see a film than a play. It's just personal, but I don't know whether the theater isn't somewhat of a dying proposition. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Yes. Yes. Oh. Microphone.
I'd just like to hear a little bit about your writing habits.
Oh, well, there's not much to tell. I just sit down and write. That I write mostly in the daytime, from about 11 or 10 o'clock in the morning till about 6 in the evening. And that's about it. Right there.
Is the apomorphine treatment that you've written about in Junkie, is that still being neglected by the U.S. medical authorities?
It's being neglected by the U.S. medical authorities, yes.
Still.
There have been a revival of interest in Denmark and other places, and they've gotten some very good results. But the American Medical Establishment has never accepted it at all. They don't know anything about it. They don't even know how the treatment works. They think of it as an aversion therapy when it's not. You see, Dent always stressed that it was not an aversion therapy, that apomorphine re-regulates the metabolism so you don't need drugs or alcohol or whatever, and that the recent discoveries about endorphin would indicate that withdrawal is caused because the body has stopped producing its natural painkiller, which is endorphin, natural regulator and painkiller, since the receptors are blocked with opiate like heroin or morphine. So when the opiate is withdrawn, it takes the body a certain time to get back into production. And without your natural painkiller, any little, you know, just the slightest thing is excruciating. So there is some evidence that both acupuncture and apomorphine stimulate the production of endorphin, the natural painkiller, so to normalize the metabolism more rapidly.
What is it that they seem to be so scared of it? The fact that they couldn't make any money out of it?
Well, there's no doubt about it that the American Narcotics Department was definitely conspiring to keep the whole show on the road and to spread it around, missionary work, as they called it, spreading it to Puerto Rico and England and all sorts of places. See, England used to have the doctors could prescribe all they wanted, and so the addicts got their heroin on the public, what is it called, the health bill or whatever it's called, public health. Well, then the Americans came in there and started agitating, and now that's becoming difficult, and they have just the same story as we've got here, thousands of addicts and people ODing in subway toilets and stealing and all the rest of it. So they were never interested in a cure. And to this day, there's very little. You see, there aren't any public appropriations for a cure. There are the two places, Lexington and Fort Worth, that just give a reduction cure with methadone, which is, if they can't come up with something that better than De Quincey did that, he gave himself a reduction cure. But they've never developed anything in the way of treatment beyond De Quincey. And there are lots of leads. I mean, they're pulling their feet, there's no doubt about it. Questions? Yes.
If you were a unproduced a script writer and you gave a script to a producer, what would prevent him from just stealing that from you? I mean,
lots of things. In the first place, it is important, as I stress, you don't do anything until you see some money. In other words, it's an old trick to have some guy try to draw you out in conversation and get your ideas. There's no protection for that. But as soon as you write even a film treatment, there is protection. Naturally, you're usually dealing through an agent or somebody, and you have photostats of this. I mean, you can have, certified copies made if you want, in front of a notary. So there is protection at that stage. As I say, it's very unwise to give anything until you see some money.
So it really doesn't happen anymore? I've heard in the early days it did.
I wouldn't say that it doesn't happen. But usually it happens, I think, that the people have been talking in conversation. See, there isn't much protection there. You say, I got a great idea for a film script. And you're talking with some guys in the Hilton or something, and you don't have any protection there. But as soon as you write it down, then you have some protection. Much more. Pardon? Yeah, yes, if you want to.
Just commenting on what you said, a friend of mine wrote a screenplay about Frank and Jesse James about 6 years ago with a friend of his, Jim Keach, whose brother is Stacy Keach. And since then, it's been rewritten 17 times, and it'll be out next year. So he'll maybe get part of the story, but his name won't even be listed. So even though he did all of the research, he might get a walk-on part, and part of the story idea, maybe, you know, $3,000 or $5,000. So there are other ways of stealing a script, or, you know, buying rights to the story and then totally rewriting it.
Well, that's an old story in Hollywood. It happens again and again. Somebody will start the script, then the studio doesn't like it. They call in another guy to rewrite it. And it isn't usually rewritten that many times, but many of them are rewritten 4, 5, 6 times. So the people that originally worked on the script may be shoved out and not even get their name on the credits in many cases.
Yeah, I know that happened to the screenwriter Robert Towne before, you know, and he's won an Academy Award finally, but he spent several years just being a script doctor and never got credit for really, you know, doing a good job on scripts.
Yeah, that happens all the time, no doubt about it. Yeah.
Do you do a lot of revision in your writing, or do you follow Jack Kerouac's idea of writing as it comes?
I do a lot of revising, usually about 3 or 4 versions. Jack said that the first version is always the best, but I told him, Jack, that may work for you, but it doesn't work for me. Mm-hmm. See, something that works very well for one writer doesn't necessarily work for another at all. So I just look at the first draft as sort of a sketch, like a rough sketch, and then I go over it usually 3, often 4 times, sometimes more, depending on the... Straight narrative is sometimes pretty easy if you're really in the flow of it. I sometimes only have to do that about 2 times, but description is another matter that's difficult. So I do a lot of revising, yes.
Okay. Could you give some brief comments on the soft machine?
Well, hardly. I was using a lot of cut-ups in there, I think perhaps too many. I was just starting to use the technique. And writers can get interested in a technique and carry it too far, I think, is like... James Joyce in Finnegan's Wake, spending 20 years on a great book that no one can read. It's, I find it difficult to read Finnegan's Wake. So, yes.
Cobblestone Garden seems to have a minimum of cut-up material in it. I was wondering if at a certain point stylistically you began composing in a kind of cut-up motif. As did you begin thinking that way, or have you left it behind? Where did you cross a line there?
Well, Cobblestone Gardens, a lot of the material in there is material that dates back to the time when Naked Lunch was being written, before I had any any experience or knowledge of the cut-ups. There is some cut-up material in there from Rambo and various places, just woven in, but a lot of it, as I say, dates back to the 1959 and before. More questions? Yes.
I've got a question about, like, I've never read 1984, but there's a lot of conversation about, you know, we're there, you know, and it's like, I feel automated a whole lot, you know. Like, I'll do something and don't even know why I do it, you know. It's like the bell rings and I do something. And I was wondering, like, how far or how close are we to, like, a world government, you know? Would it surprise you if tomorrow there was a new regime?
Would surprise me very much. I don't see much evidence of world government. I mean, more and more... small countries becoming autonomous, and It doesn't seem to me that things are moving in that direction. They're moving rather towards dispersal, I think. No, I think that 1984 is pretty far off the mark. And all his, police and thought police and so on, they just don't seem to be around. I feel that it's not a very accurate prophecy, in other words, or prophetic novel. Yes.
I agree with you. Especially considering, it seems like now there's going to be a mini civil war in Afghanistan. You have a type of mullah Muslim Brotherhood arising out of Central Asia again. And, don't you think that's kind of interesting the way that's happening?
Yeah. This gentleman over here,
I wanted to get back to this matter of the cut-up technique that you were using. Mm-hmm. When I first read that, I was very bewildered by it. And as I thought about it after a few days, it reminded me very much of the kind of thing that James Joyce had done in Finnegan's Wake. And I thought, in fact, at that time that you might have borrowed part of the idea from him. And that made me feel better. But I'm wondering now if, in light of your comments, if you have ever thought about any similarity between those two techniques, the type of thing that he did in Finnegan's Wake and the type of thing that you did in The Cutout. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I don't think it's similar. You see, Brian Geisen was the one that first developed the cut-ups, and he was a painter. He said that writing is 50 years behind painting, and he simply applied the montage technique to writing, which is old hat in painting now. There's, for example, you walk around the street, walk around the block, and come back and put what you've seen down on canvas, you've got a jumble of fragments, right?
Right.
You don't have a representational picture. So I think it's the montage method then, when you see when the writer or artist had to develop something new because of photography. That was one of the first things that they did, was montage. So this was simply applying that same technique to writing, the montage technique. That is, for example, you do the same thing with writing, come back and write what you say, and you've got pretty much of a jumble of fragments. That is, in other words, life is a cut-up. That is, wherever you walk down the street, look out the window, your consciousness is cut by random factors. And we were simply making this explicit with a pair of scissors, taking a page and arbitrarily cutting it and moving it around.
Well, I can see how you have drawn a relationship between your oranges into painter's apples, but my question is, what is the relationship? Why is it not similar what he did and what you did in terms of combining words at odd angles or in different ways?
I just don't think that he actually cut the pages. That's all. Which is an important point. You see, as Brian says, this gives the writer a chance to touch and handle his medium. I just don't think that he was doing that, although he may have. I frankly have not carefully read Finnegan's Wake. I read it years and years ago. So I couldn't say for sure that he never actually cut and moved the words around. And Anatole France, years ago, said he wrote with scissors, that is, he cut a sentence out and moved it around. Whether he actually cut through the sentences or not, I don't know. Alan?
Joyce, I think, collected words on little pieces of paper for Finnegan's Wake. He collected words on pieces of paper and then shuffled the papers around. So there may have been some similarity there. But he'd accumulate a whole file of words under different subjects.
Who did this?
James Joyce.
Oh, James. Oh, did he?
Yeah. Particular rivers, place names, and also combination words, a combination of different languages. So, but he did it just sort of to make a file.
Yeah.
And he didn't intention, I don't think at any point he assembled them at random, though.
I didn't know that, so there is a similarity there, decidedly.
A couple of years ago, there was an interview in which you mentioned there was either existing or about to be formed some sort of an academy in Scotland where psychiatric applications were being used for putting videotapes over the person, tape recorders. Some of the things you write in your book were being actually worked out in reality. Has anything ever come of that?
Nothing came of it at all. It was just a prospectus. And I left England shortly after that. No, it was just an idea. It never got beyond the idea stage, really.
Do you usually have an idea of what you're going to write when you sit down and write every day?
Yeah, some idea. I may change it. I may get all sorts of other ideas. But, you know, you have to have some place to start. Sometimes much clearer than others. But generally speaking, yes, I would say I do have an idea.
Do you write more in a linear sequence now? Like following a certain theme for a novel? Or?
Well, I always did. Like Naked Lunch is full of straight narrative. And I feel that you can't dispense with a straight linear narrative and have anybody read it. Not entirely.
Do you have any magic words, words from the Kabbalah, or words that you come back to in order to get started?
No, I don't. I know what you mean. I don't. Really.
I don't know how to phrase this question. It's almost like, what do you want from life, you know? Don't be too Buddhist about it either.
Read Korzybski. It's too general a question. And what you want and what you get are two different things, obviously.
The man was talking about catchphrases. What is rotten ectoplasm?
What is what?
Rotten ectoplasm. And why that saline term catch your fancy so much?
I can't understand it.
The term rotten ectoplasm?
Yeah, well.
I'm just curious, why did that?
The late Eileen Garrett was particularly good at producing ectoplasm.
No, that isn't what I meant.
So it's something that could easily be rotten. It's sort of semi-organic matter.
When you were reading the part from Mr. Bowles, talking about the awning flap, where the awning flaps, which you've gone back and used. To these other lines of certain people that do catch your fancy, you keep coming back to them. Is reprise progress?
Well, the thing is, writers get their material from all sorts of places. See, until I reread this book, Beating Out the Bones, I did not know that I had gotten that phrase from, arty tight, no principles. And I think that's quite legitimate. That is, what is writing is things you hear, overhear, phrase you read somewhere, and it's often very hard to know where they come from. But it's part of your total input.
Was Dead on Arrival cut up, the first chapter of Soft Machine?
Yeah, there's a lot of cut-ups in there.
It seems almost like in painting a cut-up, no matter how the montage would still have some of the artist's idea in it, whether he's still going to make some sort of judgment in what he uses and what he doesn't use, to where when you just absolutely cut a page in half, you're like making chance music or chance words. Somehow there is, it seems like, a difference there.
No, I never said that you had to use all the material. I may make a cut up and only get a sentence that I want to use. Mm. There's no obligation to use it all. And many of them don't work at all. Sometimes, you know, when I'm in a bind, I don't know where the narrative's going, I may get an idea from cutting up a page or two.
Then the idea.
I don't have to use that at all. I may just use the some of the ideas from it that emerge from it.
That's fine.
Questions? If not, we'll close this evening. Wednesday night. Yes, where will this be?
The reading will be at NISA Auditorium.
Uh-huh.
William Seward Burroughs, Jr., if he's well enough to get in from Denver Institute.